Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 5, delivered on January 26, 2010. The title of this lecture is Monetary Policy.
Today, monetary policy. The impact of monetary policy on business cannot be understated. What is done at the federal level in terms of the Federal Reserve's decisions and those of the Congress and the President have enormous impact on our business decisions. In finance, our decisions are driven primarily in terms of investments chosen and investments rejected by the interest rate environment that is prevailing. If I can get a project that will return on my investment 8%, and the prevailing interest rate environment ensures that I can obtain money at 6%, then I will certainly take that project. But if interest rates rise to 10%, and my project that I'm considering can deliver only 8%, I will reject the project. That means that the shape of business activity is in the hands of the interest rate environment, which is propelled by monetary policy as well as by other factors. Monetary policy in the United States is carried out by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is separate from but a part of the federal government. It operates independently, specifically so that monetary policy is not driven by politics. The reality is that it certainly is driven by politics. The politics of accommodation and the politics of spite. There are many times I can show you when the Federal Reserve has been nothing but a printing press for the Congress and the President for their decisions. At other times, the Federal Reserve has been the denier of money for the specific and unquestionable purpose of wrecking a presidency. There is no question that it does both. During the Bush administration, the Federal Reserve printed money like there was no tomorrow to accommodate low taxes and wars. That was the reality of it. This same Federal Reserve is now printing money like there's no tomorrow to accommodate the Obama administration's decisions. But the Federal Reserve also, during the Clinton administration, chose to take a contrarian approach. And in fact, there is good evidence, and I will put it on paper, that the Federal Reserve attempted to shape the election of 2000 by contracting the money supply as we came towards the election. There is no question that monetary policy has a political edge to it, even though the point of creating a Federal Reserve system was, at least in part, to separate monetary policy from the politics of the government. Go ahead.
If the president appoints, the director of the, how is it separate?
The chairman of the Federal Reserve, the president appoints with the advice and consent of the Congress, but at the same time, the president then has no control over those people. Frequently, the individuals who are at the Federal Reserve, especially at the chairman level, begin their careers as highly respected members of the financial community. The great towering giant, Paul Volcker, was a good example. He didn't care who the president was. He pursued a monetary policy independent of politics. And former Chairman Volcker, is still alive, and one of the saving graces of the Obama administration is that Volcker is an advisor to Obama now. However, He was, after him, was appointed his underling, Alan Greenspan, who began his career highly respected and a very objective man, although not as objective in his monetary policy as Volcker. As time went on, Alan Greenspan became a more spiteful man. He went before Congress in 1996, and he began this tirade over the years that followed about how the stock market was having irrational exuberance. Those were his words, irrational exuberance. Stock markets do not have irrational exuberance. There is no such thing as irrational exuberance in a stock market. That's like saying that a hurricane has irrational exuberance. Stock markets comprise millions and millions of trades every hour, billions and trillions of dollars. No, there's no irrationality there. So when he first starts predicating his contractionary monetary policy by saying that he has to stop the irrationality of a stock market, that's when the man has lost his credibility. And as he contracted the money supply, as he tried to stop a growth cycle that went on and on, despite his efforts to crush it, that's a man who has lost his ability to see the world objectively and to carry out his duties objectively. And then lo and behold, the same man who said that there was irrational exuberance in the stock market, who brought up the discount rate a historical number of times consecutively, suddenly starts the printing presses. When the tax cuts started to come in, he printed the money to accommodate irresponsible tax policy and spending policy. And Ben Bernanke is now in there. Nice Uncle Ben. He wants his job again, so he's just going to print money like there's no tomorrow. Let me go through the tools of monetary policy with you. In order of frequency of use and essentially the bluntness of them, from the most blunt to the least blunt. The Federal Reserve, as I described in the last lecture, sets the required reserve ratio. That's its first tool. Now, the required reserve ratio drives the growth rate of the money supply by virtue of the money multiplier, which in its simplistic form, and the more sophisticated form isn't that much more complicated, is 1 over the required reserve ratio. Therefore, as a required reserve ratio goes down, the multiplier effect magnifies, as I showed you last time. And I encourage you to make sure you understand that magnifying effect. As the required reserve ratio is elevated, the money multiplier is dampened. Truth be told, the actual money multiplier is a little more complicated than this because we don't just put money in the bank. Sometimes we hold money in our pockets, which actually puts a brake on the money multiplier. So the real money multiplier is actually a little bit more complicated than just 1 over RRR. It's this thing right here. But I would not hold you responsible for that. K is the amount of the percentage of money that's held in cash balances in your pocket. And you'll see that that thing can actually put a brake on the money multiplier if people are holding lots of their money in their pockets instead of putting it into their bank accounts, into their checking accounts. This one, again, is a blunt instrument. And in modern times, it doesn't move around a whole lot. Right now, this ratio, there's not a single ratio. There is one for different sizes of deposits, for one thing. So tranches drive the RRR. There are some banks that don't have a required reserve ratio by virtue of size and of the institution and the amount of demand deposits. So I take this one off the board. It's very rarely going to have much of an effect. If it is used, it can be quite a thing to see, though, because it actually is a multiplier. The second one goes to the heart of something deeper in finance. And I'm going to use a word here. I'm going to write a word on the board, and then I want to talk about it for just a little bit, because I'll come back to this in this course several times. The word is, I wrote it wrong, signal. What the hell was that all about? Signal. Now, in finance, as in life, we signal. Companies signal their health by various means. They will signal their health by the dividend that they declare. If we continue to have the same dividend payout ratio, or the same level of dividend, especially, that's a signal to the investment community, to our shareholders and to everyone else, that we're in good shape. That's a signal. If we raise the dividend a little bit, that would be a signal that we're doing better. These are signals, and they're very important in finance. Tea leaves. It's sort of like in oftentimes we put tea leaves down and we have the investment community look at the tea leaves to see how we're doing. Now, in Federal Reserve policy, the second tool of monetary policy is actually a signal. It's not in and of itself much to do with real effect, but it indicates what the Fed's thinking is. This signal is the discount rate. The discount rate. Now, banks can acquire funds, borrow funds from one of two places. Well, I'm being a little bit simplistic here, but from one of two places. I'll make it simple. They can go to the interbank lending market, what's called the federal funds market, this vast ocean of money that is that banks have. And they can borrow money there if they need some money overnight or if they need money for something. That federal funds market has an interest rate that is driven by supply and demand dynamics of the market. Large amounts of cash would tend supply a large supply of cash would tend to suppress the federal funds rate. If the amount of cash in the federal funds market is lower, then that would tend to elevate the federal funds rate. But banks can borrow in the federal funds market at the federal funds rate. That's a private market, and it's a market-driven rate. Even though the Federal Reserve can move, can try to influence this rate, it is driven by supply and demand conditions. On the other hand, the banks could also go to the Federal Reserve itself, to what we call the discount window, and borrow money from the Fed. The Fed will charge the discount rate. It will announce this rate, and it will say this is what we would charge banks to if they want to borrow money from us here at the Fed. Now, the discount rate will historically be lower than the federal funds rate. So why would banks ever go to the federal funds market if they could always go to Uncle and borrow money at the discount window at a slight, at a somewhat lower rate? Why would they do that? That's kind of obvious if you think about it. You've just had a terrible accident with your car, and you've got to come up with $500 today to fix it. I mean, it turns out that there was the $500 is because when the cops came, they noticed that there was some green stuff in leafy form all over the place in the car, and there was sort of like the remains of a body. And so, you know, you really need to get that car out of the impounding lot before they really begin to look around in there, okay? So you need $500 real soon. Now, which would you rather borrow from? Your dad, who would charge you no interest and bitch his head off at you, or borrow it from your friend here who would charge you 20% interest?
My dad.
You would?
I listened to his lecture.
Damn! No, okay. See, so most people wouldn't. No, I'll stay away from Daddy's big. I mean, he was in the Marines. He'll slap my ass all over the place. Stop it. You haven't had enough trouble. Okay. Most people would go to someone other. You will do anything not to go home and with your hands in front of you. I need some money. Why?
It's because
No, you're not going to do that because the Federal Reserve has these things called microscopes, and they'll start maybe putting them up your ass to find out why you need money. They will ask you questions. They will look into you, maybe. Not really, but you see, there is a reason why you would prefer to go to your friends in the interbank lending market rather than to the discount window. Now, how much do banks avoid the discount window? Not as much as they used to because the Federal Reserve has gotten so friendly with its lending policies. But you see, the Federal Reserve posts the discount rate. And then it has these meetings about 8 times a year where they decide whether they're going to hold the discount rate where it is, move it down, or move it up. Usually if they move it, it's a quarter of a point, sometimes maybe half a point. Now, if the Federal Reserve has a discount rate of, let's say, 1.5%, and it comes out of a meeting and it says, we are going to lower the discount rate to 1.25%, that would indicate that the Federal Reserve is worried about the economy and it wants to lower interest rates a little bit. Now, whether or not banks actually go to the discount window or not to borrow money, the Federal Reserve is signaling the world, the markets specifically, that it feels that the interest rate environment should be brought down a little bit. Now, if the Federal Reserve were to raise the discount rate, it would be signaling the markets that it had the sense that the economy was heating up too much, and so it is wants to cool off the economy a little bit. So this discount rate is not so much operational as it is a signal of what the sense and sensibilities of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors is. That is part of the story. The Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate. It can, however, set a target for what it would like it to be. I am forever amazed when these meetings are over with the financial news networks, and I've got documented evidence of these supposedly expert pundits saying the Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate at. No, the Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate. It is a market rate. The Federal Reserve can say we'd like to see it here and we're going to make some efforts to move it to there, but it cannot set the federal funds rate. It can set only the discount rate. The federal funds rate, again, is a market rate, what the banks would lend money to each other at. So the discount rate is by and large a signal, historically. It simply signals the markets, this is what the Fed is thinking about the economy's direction and strength right now. In stable economic times, the Federal Reserve will hold the discount rate at a certain level. But historically, the discount rate was not particularly used by banks. But these days, the Federal Reserve has set the rate so friggin' low, the banks are lining up for this money Uncle Fed is handing out at virtually zero interest. The odd thing about it is that even though this interest rate has been low, extraordinarily low by historical standards, the banks are not using the money that they're getting. They're holding it. At the end of the course, you're going to see why that could happen when I get to working capital management policy. It's a fascinating thing when we want to stimulate the economy. We want banks to get money and to lend it out, and the banks aren't doing it. It just drives us crazy. Come on, we need this economy to pick up steam. Lend money, banks. And the banks sit there, no, we're just going to keep all this money that we got. We're going to get more, and we're going to from the government, and we're just going to keep it. What? Why are you doing that? Well, first of all, if it's zero interest, what keeps them from acquiring it? Second, if they're afraid of the economy's condition, they're just going to hold on to that money and use it for their own purposes other than to unlock the credit markets, which were pretty badly frozen up and still aren't in great shape right now. Okay, now, the last tool of monetary policy has to do with the federal funds rate, but it's a broader subject. The third and most common tool of monetary policy is open market operations, OMOs. And to do this, I have to do some supply and demand dynamics. But I also have to describe a little bit about the structure of the Federal Reserve itself. The Federal Reserve comprises, as I told you last time, and as I'm sure you've read in the in my articles and on the, in that video, the Federal Reserve comprises seven governors. One of those seven is the chairman. And then there are six others. Cream of the crop, historically, very astute people. Internally, they don't think as one. Historically, the Federal Reserve has had had governors that were inflation hawks and governors who were more interested in growth, not worrying as quite as much about inflation. But the Board of Governors, when it votes as a single voice. And only later do we see the internal memos that were, or some of the internal deliberations that were going on. But now we have the seven governors of the Federal Reserve at the top of the food chain. And remember that in one of their jobs, these cats regulate the banking system. And then below the governors are the 12 bank presidents, the 12 reserve bank presidents, one for each region, reserve, Federal Reserve region of the country. Now, there is a committee. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. The FOMC, this is going somewhere, trust me. I've just got to do some setup, the structure. The FOMC comprises all seven governors and five bank presidents. And you just saw me right here on the board, four. The four serve on a rotating basis. Each one serves for a couple of years and then is replaced by another one. One bank president has a permanent seat on the FOMC. That is the president of the New York Bank. What's called the Empire Bank. This guy sits permanently, has a permanent seat, because the bank in New York, the Reserve Bank in New York, is the location of what is called the domestic trading desk. The domestic trading desk is at the New York Fed. This is where the action occurs with regard to open market operations. So this guy sits there. As I raged about in my last lecture, the former president of the Reserve Bank of New York was Timothy Geithner. He is now the Treasury Secretary. Mr. Geithner, aside from being a man who doesn't have a keen idea of paying his federal taxes, was the bank president when the financial crap hit the fan. And yet he somehow managed to rise now to the Treasury Secretary from that illustrious performance at the Fed in New York. Now here's how it works. The Federal Reserve, the FOMC, makes a decision about the direction of monetary policy. Should we increase the money supply to stimulate the economy, or should we decrease the money supply to slow down the economy? And, of course, there's always the one where we'll hold the money supply right where it is. Now, ideally, the money supply should grow at the real growth rate of the economy. If the economy grows at 2%, the money supply should grow at 2%. That's why monetarist economists will say, this is a computer program. This shouldn't be some debate internally among people who are not elected. This should be just a mechanical system that ensures that the money supply expands at the real growth rate of the economy. But that's not how it works. The Federal Reserve decides whether to help the economy or to hurt the economy based upon whether the economy is moving towards recession or towards inflation. So, the FOMC makes a decision about the direction of monetary policy. The decision that it makes is then transmitted through the New York Bank president, who is at the FOMC meetings voting, to the domestic trading desk, which then executes the appropriate market actions to cause the money supply to do what the FOMC wants it to do. Here's how it goes. And I'll do it with stimulative monetary policy because that's what we have been in for so long. We're going to have to go to a contractionary monetary policy here soon enough because the inflation is just building terribly. But I'm going to go through the dynamics of an expansionary monetary policy. Hold on to your hats. Here we go. And you have to remember some principles that I've told you already. The FOMC makes a decision to expand the money supply. To stimulate the economy. Now, that is articulated to the domestic trading desk in New York. And the manager at the desk then gives the marching orders to the traders. And this is not just a little tiny place. This is an enormous, complex operation. But underneath it, the principle is very simple. You see, at the domestic trading desk, we'll take a typical trader. Who looks like a trader here? You look like you could be a domestic trading desk trader. The serious glasses and the business haircut, you look like a trader. Okay, now, you will have an inventory that will include dollar bills and another highly liquid instrument. Do you remember I talked about a highly liquid instrument that was virtually a perfect substitute for dollars? Do you remember when I talked about that? Does anyone remember what that other highly liquid instrument is? Tradable, highly tradable? Yeah. T-bills. Oh, I love it. T-bills. So you're going to have an inventory of dollars and you're also going to have treasury bills. And I'll draw a bunch of little dollar signs, and I'll draw a bunch of T's. Now, you're also going to have a Rolodex. And I'm simplifying this terribly. You've got a Rolodex. Now, let's say that I am a bank, just a typical happy little bank, sitting on the edge of nowhere, and I've got, at my little bank, as far as Tier 1 assets go, I'll have an inventory of dollars, and I will also have an inventory of something else that's very safe, T-bills. I'll have both of these on hand. Okay, now, the dollars are going to sit in what's called the federal funds market, that vast ocean of money that the banks all together have. You got your money there. You got T-bills in the vault. And you're just sitting there. And, well, let me be the bank president. I'm just sitting here. I'm happy. I got some money. I got some T-bills. I got decent asset base. I'm safe. And then you call me. You call me. And you say, I want to make a deal with you. Kind sir. I got a great deal for you. Now, you've been given your marching orders. The money supply is to be expanded. So what do you want to give me to expand the money supply? You've got two things. What do you want to give me to expand the money supply of the two things in your inventory? Do you want to give me dollars or T-bills if you want to expand the money supply in the marketplace, in the federal funds market? I can't use T-bills. I can't. That's not money. That's T-bills. If you want me to have more money to lend out, to put into the federal funds pool, you've got to get me to take dollars. You've got to get me to take dollars. So what do I have that you can offer to buy from me and give me dollars? What is it that is a perfect substitute almost? It's my T-bills. You're going to offer to buy my T-bills from me. You're going to offer to buy my T-bills from me. Okay, let's say you offer me $950 for one of my T-bills. I'm going to say, I'm not going to sell you a T-bill at that price. Why would I sell you a T-bill? Come on, get off the phone. I got people to talk to. So you call me back a few minutes later. You've got to get me. You got to get me to sell some of my T-bills to you. You've got to get me to take some money. So you call me back a few minutes later. What are you going to say? I want to help her out. She offered me $950. I hung up on her. Don't say $1,000, for God's sake. That's par. For God's sake, we're not in 2010 where that actually happens. Let's say you're going to offer me more. You're going to call me up and say, look, you asshole. You hung up on me at $950, I'll give you $975, and I'll say, bite me, bye, click. So you call me back a few minutes later. What are you going to say? No, don't say $1,000, for God's sake, that's par. $980. Okay, you're going to bid until you get me to say sold. What happens to the discount rate? Do you remember the yield thing I showed you before? As the price of a T-bill goes up, what happens to the yield on a T-bill? It goes down. So by virtue of the fact that you guys are entering the market trying to buy my T-bills from me, you are pushing the yields on government treasury bills downward. That in itself will have an effect on all interest rates because that means all interest rates can settle downward by the same mechanism as any other product. If one product price goes down, it'll bring down other product prices. So by virtue of the fact that you guys from the domestic trading desk are entering into the banking system and saying we want to buy T-bills, you are going to drive the T-bill price up because the demand for T-bills is increasing. Look, what's happening here on this leg of the journey? Here's the supply, here's the demand for treasury bills. And here's the price of treasury bills. You guys are calling all over the country from the domestic trading desk, and you are trying to buy T-bills from banks. As you do that, you're going to push the demand for T-bills outward. As you flood the market with demand for T-bills, buy, buy, buy. You're calling all over the country, buying T-bills from banks. We want your T-bills. We'll pay you cash money. And if you order before midnight, we'll also throw in a Ronco Vegematic. No, sorry, I got into it. The price of T-bills drops. But as the... What do I do? I got my supply and demand. No wonder, God almighty, I got my supply... Supply one. Oh, I see what I did wrong. I'm talking and writing at the same time. Erase that. God almighty. Demand. Supply. Okay, as the demand originally was there at price one, as the demand for T-bill surges to D2, the price rises to P2. As the price of the T-bills rises, that means that the yields on T-bills are dropping. By virtue of this flood of powerful activity, we're talking about, you're not going to mess with it. You're going to buy lots and lots of T-bills. In fact, now going to the present time, the domestic trading desk on some days has been so aggressively buying T-bills from banks that private institutions that need T-bills at the end of the day to balance their portfolios, they can't find them. Literally, in the current time, in the past few months, I have talked to money managers at large corporations. They've said, at the end of the day, we couldn't find any T-bills no matter what price we paid. And that was what led to that conversation I had. This one woman, she finally found some T-bills, was able to buy some T-bills at the end of the day as part of a package When she separated out and calculated the T-bill yields, she said the T-bill yields were negative. She said, that can't happen, can it? Well, yeah, it can. It shouldn't happen. Literally, the domestic trading desk had caused the price to go up so much by its buying that day that the price went up over par, which would have created the effect of a negative, slightly negative interest rate. That's how aggressively the Fed has been trying to keep interest rates down, driving the yields on T-bills down. But that's not the end of the story. That's not the end of the story, because here comes the second round effect. Remember how I said that the Federal Reserve can't set the federal funds rate, but it can affect it. It sets a target for it, and then it tries to move the federal funds rate through towards that target. This is how it's actually doing it. You see, because if I look at what's happening over here with this domestic trading desk and its interaction with the banks, if you are buying treasury bills at the domestic trading desk, that means that you are actually, you are actually bringing T-bills from the bank over here to the desk. And as a consequence of that, you are paying the bank money for them, which goes into the federal funds pool, that bank's account in the federal funds pool. As you buy more of these T-bills, you put more money into that bank's account in the federal funds market. Okay? Now, if I look at what's going on then in the federal funds market, there was a supply of money in the federal funds market. Lendable funds, call it. And there was an interest rate, the federal funds rate, that was being charged for that. That federal funds rate that was prevailing was the result, as I said, of supply and demand conditions in the federal funds pool. But if the Fed is pumping money into banks' accounts, that would mean that the supply of lendable funds is swinging outward from S1 to S2. If the supply of funds is swinging outward, that would mean that the federal funds rate is falling. That's how the Fed manipulates the federal funds rate. Because at the same time that it's causing this yield effect on government instruments, it's also creating the effect that there is a larger supply of funds for banks to lend. And if there's a larger supply of funds for banks to lend, they can lend at a lower rate. So it's a double effect. Monetary open market operations cause yields on government debt to fall, but at the same time, they're causing the federal funds rate to fall as well, because they are flooding the federal funds market with dollars. You see, a bank can't lend T-bills. They're safe. They are every bit as good as a dollar, but a bank can't lend T-bills. So in the end, what the Fed's expansionary monetary policy is aimed at is moving the liquidity balance of a bank away from T-bills and toward dollars. So essentially, if I were to look at it like a fulcrum and a lever, with the bank having on one side of the fulcrum dollars and on the other side having treasury bills as its safe assets, its tier one types of assets, what the Fed is trying to do is lighten this up, make it smaller as the portfolio component of the liquid assets, and beef up this part so that the balance of the funds in a bank moves towards lendable cash money and away from unlendable treasury bills. That's what the Fed is doing through the execution of expansionary open market operations. It's actually trying to tip the balance of the bank's safe assets. Dollars and T-bills are both terribly safe, very safe, but it's trying to tip that toward dollars and away from treasuries. Now, what does that mean to you in business? A whole hell of a lot, because if you need, as I said, to analyze projects on a go, no-go basis, which is what we do, there's no nuance, it's either yes or no. We need those interest rates to go down in order for us to actually accept more projects. And as the Fed causes the prevailing interest rate environment from the yields on government instruments over to the federal funds rate, as the Fed causes interest rates to fall, that will give banks, businesses more investments that are go instead of no-go. That's why this matters hugely to us in the world of finance, more so than in any other branch of business, more so than any other discipline in business. We care about this. We watch the Fed to see what its decision-making process is. We try to read the tea leaves. The Fed is still in this expansionary monetary mode right now. It is still pouring money into the market, literally pouring money into the market. And then, as a secondary whopper on this whole process, let's try something. The Fed is expanding the money supply. Where's it getting that money? Let's try this. Where's it getting that money? Darn it, you made it easy. Ah, you're no fun anymore. It just prints it. Are you allowed to do that when you need money?
The Fed is, I guess.
No, you. No. Are you allowed? Yeah, if you did that, you'd be some hard-timer's old lady.
Right.
Okay, you're not allowed to do that. The Fed, literally, in order to do this trick, simply prints the money. It prints it. It just prints it. That's all there is to it. You see? And so, when the Federal Reserve prints all this money, interestingly enough, there's another effect that is really weird and that goes on. You see, what if the banks really, they're getting all this money, but they don't want to lend it. Well, do they just let the federal funds market swell and swell and swell until it explodes? Well, to a certain extent, that looks like what they're doing now. M1 is just going crazy, unlike it has for the last 8 years or so, certainly for the last 4 years or so. But there's something else that can be really weird. Another player, an 800-pound gorilla. Where do T-bills come from? Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever met the T-bill fairy? You haven't? So you don't know that T-bills are brought to us by a fairy who sticks them under the pillow of the national psyche. You didn't know that?
Didn't
Okay. What story did you hear of where T-bills come from? Okay. Well, I told you. The story that we tell is that T-bills come from the government. When it wants to borrow money, it issues T-bills. That's its security for borrowing money, okay? But really, it's a T-bill fairy that does it. Okay, now, is the government borrowing a little bit of money now, or is it borrowing gobs and gobs of money?
Gobs.
And so the government is producing gobs and gobs of treasury bills, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's where the T-bills come from this thing over here called the government, which is pumping out T-bills like a rabbit pumps out bunnies. Constantly, auction after auction after auction, these T-bills are pumping out the government borrowing money. Now, there are a couple of places that lend the government huge amounts of money. One is foreign countries do. Where do they get the dollars? They get them because we buy their cheapo products. They collect the dollars in their central banks, and then they go to our treasury auctions and lend the government money, which makes us beholden to those foreign governments. But that's another story. There's another place where they could actually get people, get something that would buy these. Look at that cycle over there. You see how the Fed is buying up treasury bills from the banks and then giving the banks money. Well, you know what the banks will do? If they don't want to lend you money out of that federal funds pool, you know what they're going to do? They're going to take those dollars and they're going to buy T-bills. And then how do they get rid of the T-bills? The Federal Reserve comes and buys them up in open market operations. This is how the Federal Reserve prints money to fund the United States government. Is effectively, the cycle works like this. The Federal Reserve buys T-bills from the banks and puts money into the federal funds market. But then the banks take their money that they just got from the Fed and they go and they replace those T-bills that were bought by the Fed with the money that the Fed paid them for the last round of T-bills that they sold to the Fed, the banks sold to the Fed. And then in the next round, the Fed will come in and provide the banks with more money, which will bring T-bills to the Fed. But then the banks will take that more money and go to the next treasury auction and buy more T-bills. And so the Fed will use the banks as the proxy agents, essentially as the intermediaries, to fund the federal government. That's how the cycle is working now. And the banks make a profit off this because every time this happens, when the Treasury has the auction, the supply of T-bills goes up, the price goes down, the yield goes up. So the price goes down, the banks buy them at the low price. Then when the Fed comes with its domestic trading desk to buy them, it bids the prices back up, so the banks sell the T-bills higher than they bought them at the auction. So the banks make a profit. And the banks don't have to lend to you because they can live off this cycle that's happening with the Federal Reserve. Strange world. That's how it works, though. And if you haven't heard this story before, it's because it's a little complicated, but funny how that works. Sometimes complicated works. Now I'm going to take you very quickly through contractionary monetary policy. The other side of it. And it'll actually begin to soak in a little more. And that article series that I had you read, The Federal Reserve Under Fire, I explain rather fast how this works, and it will probably make more sense if you go back and read that section on OMOs. Okay. Contractionary monetary policy. The Open Market Committee has said we have got to contract the money supply because inflation is hitting. Contractionary monetary policy. Okay, this is the FOMC. It's voting members, the 12 voting members, make this decision. We've got to drain liquidity from the banking system, and that's a fancy way of saying it. We drain liquidity. So the marching orders go to the Empire Bank, to the DTC. Now, the DTC traders have their dollar bills in their inventory, and they also have their T-bills in their inventory. The banking system has all of these banks which have a portfolio of safe assets comprising dollar bills which reside in the federal funds market and treasuries. Their portfolio, their safe portfolio comprises that. Now, this time we need to get the banks at the DTC, we need to get money away from the banks. We need to drain liquidity from the system. So if I'm going to drain liquidity from the system, talk to me. You're a, hey, good, good. You want to, you're a trader. I'm a bank. You want to get my money away from me in my bank. You don't want me to have dollar bills. You don't want to take away my safety, but you don't want me to have dollar bills because I might lend them. So you've got dollars and T-bills. Which are you going to use to get my dollars away from me?
T's.
Uh-huh. Good. You are going to do what? You're going to offer to sell me treasury bills. And you call me up and you say, I want to sell you a treasury bill. I'm at the bank. I'm the bank president. What are you going to sell me a treasury bill at? Give me a price. Say 960.
All right, 960.
I say, kiss my ass.
All right.
No, I hang up on you. You want to sell me a T-bill at $960. La-dee-da. So you call me back. What are you going to offer me this time for my for one of my tra- for what are you going to sell me a treasury bill at to get me to buy it?
$965.
You're going to ask me to pay more?
Oh.
Oh, I can guarantee you, I will call you a whole bunch of names that begin with mother. You're trying to get me to buy a T-bill. Okay, if 960 doesn't work, 965. No, you'll sell me. Give me a number. I know, I'm putting you under pressure here. But you'll go 950, right? And I'll say, bite me. Hang up. You call me back. Okay, fine. Today only. 940 and I'll throw in a toaster. What kind of toaster? A 4-slice maker. Sweet. Does it do bagels? Yes. Sold. What did he do to the price of T-bills to get me to buy? To induce me to buy, what happened to the price of T-bills? They went down. As the price of a T-bill goes down, what happens to its yield? Goes up. So this action on its own is causing the yields on treasury bills and therefore interest rates throughout the economy to begin to go upward. The dynamic there would be, in other words, you want me to buy a treasury bill for my portfolio, and you want to take away a dollar from my reserves in the federal funds market. Okay. And as a result of that, what's happening on that dynamic is we got price on this axis. We got the supply of T-bills, the demand for T-bills. Now, did I do that right that time? You are trying to get me to buy a T-bill. You want me to buy T-bills. You want me to buy T-bills. Okay. Does that mean that you're trying to sell T-bills? You're calling everywhere. I'm selling T-bills. Does that mean that the demand for T-bills is changing or the supply of T-bills is changing?
The demand.
It's a supply because you're pouring. You're literally bringing them out in boxes and trying to sell them. That's a supply. You're flooding the market with T-bills. Essentially, every trader at the desk is calling and saying, I got T-bills, I got T-bills, I got T-bills. That means that the supply of T-bills is kicking outward. So the original prevailing price, P1, goes down because the supply of T-bills is increasing to P2. The price is going down on T-bills, which means that the yield is rising on the T-bills. Boy, you have to read these notes over and over again to get this, trust me. The only reason I could do this like this is because I've done it for so long, and even I screwed up over there for a second. Okay, now, here's the other side of the action. Look at what's happening in the federal funds market. Liquidity is being drained. Dollars are actually coming out of the system where banks lend to each other and ultimately lend to consumers. Which means that if I were to look at the supply and demand conditions over here for lendable funds against the federal funds rate, here was the demand, here's the supply. But now the Fed is draining liquidity out of the banking system, which means that the supply of lendable funds is contracting from S1 to S2. And that means that the interest rates are going up. Lo and behold, that's how the Fed tries to move the discount rate. The federal funds rate. It is actually draining liquidity out of the system. So doing that fulcrum thing again like I did over there, here's the bank's fulcrum of Tier 1 assets. It's got T-bills on the left side, dollars on the right side. In this activity, effectively what the Treasury, what the Fed is doing is taking away dollars and putting T-bills into the banking system, which causes the fulcrum of liquidity to tip towards T-bills, which the banks can't lend. They're very safe, but the banks can't lend T-bills to people and businesses. And it's tipping it away from the money that could be lent. And so, effectively, the asset base, the portfolio of the bank, tips towards less liquidity. Still safe, but less liquidity. Now, this policy right here, expansionary, that's been what's been going on, especially since about 2004. It was going on since about 2001. The effect has been to keep an economy that was actually structurally unsound throughout the early years of the 21st century from collapsing. In a series that I'll assign you, not required, but it will be the subject of a book that is I should be publishing by the end of the year called The Economics of Wreckage. What was going on was that there were so many signs that the underlying structure of the economy was in very bad shape. Business investment as a percent of GDP was documentedly going down severely, noticeably. But because the Federal Reserve during those years just kept pouring money into the banking system and essentially creating this cycle of the banks living off this money and also providing for the funding of part of the federal deficits, the economy managed to keep going, although the structural integrity became less and less sound. And the financial crisis occurred in the middle of September of 2008. And in May of 2008, I wrote my last warning article, it's going to happen. It's right around the corner. Back then, everyone said, you're a conspiracy theorist and all that. But the problem was that you see, if the government can't live off its funds, and if the banks can't live off money that is existing because of sound monetary policy, you have all the makings for a disaster. And sure enough, we had it. And we're not out of it yet because this flood of money that's coming into the system here, it's still coming. It's just pouring it just to keep the economy growing, getting it out of the recession. The problem is that the growth rate of the money supply is considerably larger than the real growth rate of the economy. It has been for a very long time. And sooner or later, all of those extra dollars create inflation. And what will happen in the end, and this brings me back to the last lecture two lectures ago, on interest rates. Remember that at the end of the day, the basis of all interest rates, the substrate, underneath every interest rate in an economy is called the risk-free rate. Every interest rate has at its core this risk-free rate. It is the rate comprising the real rate of return plus an expected inflation premium. Sooner or later, no matter what the Fed does, the Fed can push the real rate down literally to where it is now as a negative number. But eventually, the expected inflation will begin to creep in, and it will grow, and it will grow. And so no matter how hard the Fed tries to keep down interest rates, there will come a time when anything they do will be to suppress our subreal will be overwhelmed by the expected inflation premium going up. And that means that the interest rates that businesses use to make their investment decisions sooner or later is going to rise. It is going to rise either because the Fed crushes the money supply and drives real interest rates through the roof by contractionary monetary policy, or it will rise because the Fed doesn't have the guts to do it, and the expected inflation premium will take the job on and do it like gangbusters. One way or the other, this has major impact, significant impact on the business environment. We make our business decisions based upon the prevailing interest rate environment. It isn't whether we love a project or hate a project. It's a project has a positive net present value or a negative net present value, and that is driven by the interest rate that we use to discount the future expected cash flows. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.